I'm hoping that this talk can be about two words. Talk can be reduced to the expression coming home. Before I go further, is the volume okay? Everyone can hear okay? Okay. So coming home. And in particular, coming home to our senses, coming to our senses. A lot of Vipassana practice is about coming to our senses, which is a great double meaning. And so I want to talk a little bit about coming home, and then I want to talk a little bit about the hindrances. And the hindrances are that which hinder us from being home. And then I'd like to talk about a set of practices to work with hindrances, that are practices that can help us be home, that go by the acronym RAFT, R-A-F-T. So that's the plan for where we're going as we go home. So, the idea of being home, for me, I'm sure it means different things for different people. Different people have different associations with being home. But one possibility is that home is a place where you can just be yourself, especially when no one's there, just you. It's a place where you're comfortable walking around in your pajamas, in your underwear. You're comfortable with not taking a shower. You're comfortable with not combing your hair. You're comfortable just being the way that you'd like to be without concerns with people's expectations or people's demands or people's, judgments of you. And there's a kind of way of when you come home, it's kind of like you drop the, to some degree, you can drop the burdens of the day, the burdens of work, the burdens of the, what happens out there. And for some people, being home is a refuge. Sometimes being home is not a refuge, but the kind of being home that I'm referring to is that of being having a refuge. For me, coming to IRC is a coming home. I feel very, not that I've walked around in pajamas here, and or don't worry, I'm not going to show up at Dharma Talk in my underwear. But more profoundly, the idea that here something happens here when I come onto this land, steps into this, the retreats here, where I just feel so at home in a comfortable way. It's a place to relax and just be and free of demands, free of needing to do a lot. Just so nice to be here. Some people, they find that sense of at-homeness maybe in nature. And spending extended periods of time in nature allows them just to be home and coming home to themselves. The idea of not being at home with ourselves is one where we're alienated from ourselves, we're not connected to ourselves, and we're not comfortable with ourselves. We're not comfortable in our own skin, not comfortable settling into our own hearts. And that's pretty easy to end up feeling uncomfortable with being present for oneself. And it's one of the big reasons why people will spin out, certainly in their thoughts and ideas, in order to stay disconnected, in order to stay from having to feel what's going on. But people also do it through all kinds of activities in the world. Some people are experts at being busy, and they can't slow down. They don't want to stop, because if they finally stop, they have to be with themselves, and that's frightening or that's painful. Difficult things might be there. Some people are intoxicating themselves. alcohol and drugs, recreational opportunities of every kind, in order to kind of somehow avoid being here. Some people have an endless pursuit of pleasure, and some people like pleasure, and like the sometimes the adrenaline of exciting things to do, and they feel very connected to themselves. But in a certain kind of way, it's a kind of a, can also be a disconnect. And one of the places, one way to see that is on retreat. It happens occasionally that someone comes who's really, really committed to running every day. And it makes them feel so good, so wonderful, and it feels so wholesome and healthy. And it's such an important part of their life. And so maybe they continue running when they're in retreat. And then they, but they get quieter and quieter during the course of the retreat. And then, it feels so good to be quiet and settled. And then that, because they have a habit of going for a run, after lunch they go for their run. And they come back and they said, that was great. I feel so vital. I feel so connected and all this joy and, you know. And it's great, yes. But then they come to sit down in the hall and their mind is spinning, racing. And it takes a long time to settle down again. All the work they did in the morning or a few days, you know, got energized, and they're spinning out again. And there sometimes is a way in which even physical activity that makes us feel connected to ourselves is not very deep. And this idea of being deeply at home, so you know, at home in our hearts, settled in ourselves in such a deep way that the belly relaxes, the heart comes to ease, and so deeply connected to, so deeply at home, so comfortable, so dropping the resistance, the barriers, dropping the all the busyness and the fears and the resistances and all the stuff that keeps us connected, being deeply, so deeply at home that our hearts become a home for the world. So deeply at home with ourselves that our hearts are so willing to be open to receive the world. Everyone's welcome into my heart. So it's a kind of a home that has no walls. It's the wall-less home that we can take with us everywhere. And it's not dependent on our physical home, but it's only dependent that we stay connected to it. But how to find that? How to find this place that feels safe, that feels comfortable, that feels some deep satisfaction, that feels like a place of rest, a place of ease, of peace, of freedom, is the task of practice. And it's really worthwhile. It's one of the most worthwhile things to do with human life is to find this kind of, to come home and have your heart then open to include everyone within it. So one of the tasks is to somehow work with the hindrances. And the hindrances are five different forces in the mind and within us that tend to keep us spinning, tend to keep us disconnected. The tradition talks about the hindrances that keep us from being connected to our wisdom. Certainly also keeps us disconnected from our ability to get concentrated. But for me, the idea of wisdom and concentration have a lot to do with being at home. Because if I think of concentration by itself in my old days, I kind of had this idea that it was a laser focus from up in the control tower. And it's actually a way of not being integrated, not being settled, composed on one's whole self, but to include everything, to be settled and composed and calm and at ease with all of what one is. That's a lot of what concentration is, to develop samadhi. And so hindrances are what keeps that samadhi at bay, keeps that integration, that wholeness, that unification, keeps it at bay because it keeps us fragmented. The Pali word for hindrances is nivarana. And the word shouldn't be confused with nirvana. The word literally means to cover over. So it's like a covering. And the word hindrance, I don't know, sometimes some people don't like the word hindrance because it sounds like a negative judgment against them, like there are these bad things that come along that hinder. But the word covering maybe represents it better, that it covers something that's precious, covers something which is integral to who we are, that we've lost touch with, and that we're taking off the cover. So by somehow shedding the hindrances, the covers come off, and we get to have a deeper connection with life, with ourselves, and with the world. So there are five hindrances, and the list actually includes seven things, because some of them have pairs. And the first two are kind of opposites from each other. They're desire, sensual desire, and ill will. And sensual desire by itself is not a hindrance, but compulsive desire for the senses is held up in Buddhism as something that can disconnect ourselves from ourselves. It isn't that Buddhism is anti-sense desire, per se, that you shouldn't have sensual pleasure, but that too often the pursuit of sensual pleasure leads to a disconnect. And you know, the strongest version of that is when people go for the pleasure of something like alcohol or drugs or sex, just for the pleasure, and there's a loss of something deeper, some deeper connection with ourselves. It's pleasurable, but it's not really happy. And so, when I was young, in my early years of practice, I got to look at desire a lot. And that's one of the tasks of practitioners, is to get to look at all the hindrances a lot. It's so important that don't go drumming up business. Don't go drumming up the hindrances. But whenever they appear, be happy. Great. This is my chance to study them. This is my chance to get to know them. And I don't think there's any really good way of becoming wise around the hindrances without really understand how they do their magic, how they work. Many people hear that you're supposed to let go of the hindrances so you can get concentrated or something. And then they just want to push them away. They want the magic button they can push, so they just kind of obliterate them once and for all. And so they don't have to deal with them because they're just a hindrance, right? And they're just a problem. So you want to get rid of problems. But a hugely big part of Buddhist wisdom is understanding how you get caught, understanding how you get disconnected, understanding how you get, what are the forces inside of you that leave you to suffering. And that's kind of bad news, that Buddhism is a lot to do about studying the very things that make your life difficult. You think you want to avoid learning about that, you know, like, give me a way out. But by studying and learning and becoming wise about how the tricks of your mind work, that's portable, and you can take it with you into many different circumstances, and you can see the dangers coming. You can see your tendencies as they begin happening. And you can learn how to practice with it in the immediate present so you don't get tripped up. But if you manage to find the secret button that you push so that these things go away, there's no guarantee that later, some other time, that there's still battery power in that little button. or that you can find the button, or they're still working. And so you won't have anything to fall back on. You won't have any understanding of what goes on and how your mind works, and so you won't have, what am I supposed to do here? I had that problem when, after a while in retreats, I started to develop a little capacity for concentration, and I learned that I could get concentrated to override whatever difficulties I was having, and that was nice, you know. I'd feel some difficulties, okay, I'll just get zero in and just blast over it. And so for a while I was cruising along very nicely, and then it stopped working. And then I felt lost. What do I do now? You know, I felt frustrated and angry and confused, and I had nothing to fall back on because I hadn't done the work of understanding what these hindrances are, how they work, how to attend to them, how to really kind of unwrap them, and really uncover them and see what's going on. So desire was one that I spent a lot of time getting to know. I'm probably of the three personality types, greed, hate, and deluded personality types, I'm probably a greed type. Desires are a dime a dozen for me. They're cheap. So I've learned over these years that just let them go by, desires are, I tell myself, oh, dime a dozen, just easy come, easy go. I don't have to pick them up. But there was a time when I used to get exhausted. At the end of the day, I was so exhausted, and I couldn't understand why, until I understood that it's because I spend much of the day wanting things. I want that, I want that, I want that, I want this. And this constant movement of desire is a kind of a tension, an exhausting tension of the mind, of the body. And once I started to learn not to follow or get preoccupied with the desires, I found I had much more energy for myself. I also found that desires were a way of avoiding myself, disconnecting. And one of the little understandings, I love the English word wanting, because it can also mean a lacking, like the soup is wanting salt. And so I discovered that sometimes my incessant desires were an attempt to try to fill my sense of lack, my sense of inadequacy, my sense of unworthiness that I had, kind of an emptiness that I had that I went around and kind of depressed. And so I was kind of reaching and trying to find something that would fill it, and like some people do with food, they feel sad or empty or something, and they fill themselves with food. And so I had to learn to not keep grabbing and wanting the desire, but rather to learn to sit with the very uncomfortable sensations of unworthiness, of inadequacy that I had. And I attribute my resolution of that, or healing from that, of sitting with it in meditation. That hour after hour after hour, day after day, I sat with all these feelings of being inadequate and feeling bad about myself, and I just sat there, I wasn't trying to get rid of it or fix it. I was just kind of being with it, being with it, being with it. And there's something that began happening when I just allowed it to be there, that it began to soften, it began to spread, it began to open, it began to settle, and it started to form cracks in it. And through the cracks, I got started to see there was something precious inside. That there was a sense of peace, there was a sense of at-homeness, a sense of wholeness that was waiting for me, that was covered over by all the desire that I had, and by all this kind of inadequacy, feelings of inadequacy I had. So I needed to kind of stop chasing the desires, to feel what the desires were covering, feel that, until something deeper began to emerge that became very, you know, essential for my, for me and my healing. Same thing with ill will. Ill will also can be a very strong way to be disconnected from oneself, just as much as desire. But both of those can be, we can fool ourselves, because just like with exercise and running, you can feel a tremendous sense of vitality and aliveness from the running. So one can feel that from with desire and ill will. And I don't know why I associate it even more with ill will than desire, but both of them. And one of the reasons why some people get pulled into desire fantasies is that you can feel really good. You can feel vital. I used to, when I was a new Zen student, I had desires of kind of fantasies, you know, desire fantasies of being a great Zen master. I'd listen to these Dharma talks, and you know, I'd start giving my own Dharma talks, and it was like all this fantasy. And so my karma then is to have to do this. But it was just a kind of, but the allure of the fantasy, you know, it was kind of like this pleasure. Or I've had sexual fantasies sitting and meditating, and it's, it's just a fantasy is so pleasant. And so the allure of that pleasure, the pull into it, not recognizing how it actually was a disconnection from myself. So the same thing with ill will. There can be a strong sense of vitality there. Aliveness, and some people can be addicted to the sense of aliveness, connectedness, efficacy, power that can come from being angry or being hostile or, you know, having, you know, lots of complaints. And sometimes the, you know, anger is justified. But even when it's justified, it's too easy for it to be a way to disconnect from oneself. Disconnect with something deeper. And sometimes, and so sometimes we have to feel them, we have to be willing to kind of feel the anger, be with it, and ask, what is it covering over? What's going on here? And with anger, it's very nice to really feel the coursing of anger within us, because there is a kind of, there's a kind of strength that comes with anger. That's why some people maybe get addicted to it, the strength. But it's actually good to be strong. And so sometimes to allow yourself to feel the anger fully allows you to kind of tap into a place of strength. And then it might be possible to keep the strength, but let the hostility of the anger fall away. Sometimes anger is a covering for frustrated desire. And so as we kind of begin to look at the anger, we start seeing how much frustrated desire we have. And there was a time in my life when my life was very limited. I had so many demands on me. I couldn't do anymore what I wanted to do. And so my desires were frustrated. And that translated it to being very angry. And so I had to kind of sit and look at the anger and be with that. The third hindrance is sloth and torpor. And kind of Victorian English words that we hardly ever use outside of Vipassana. But it's kind of, it's not ordinary tiredness, but rather as a psychological movement of resistance or dampening down or giving up, discouragement, where we don't have the adequate energy or clearness or alertness to do the practice. And it's interesting to notice how quickly we can get discouraged or how quickly we can kind of get deflated psychologically and how quickly it's possible to get inflated again, kind of get energized again. Someone can say something, and just what they say is kind of either can inspire us, and suddenly we have energy and we're ready perky and ready to go and do more practice. They can say something and we feel deflated and we're like, oh, you know, it feels hopeless. And, you know, we just kind of like our posture sags and, you know, it's like, ugh. And all that changed was someone said something or we thought about something. We tell ourselves stories and it affects our energy level. We might get all the sleep we needed and then we have a certain thought. You know, we have this raised threshold by the door. It goes up almost 3/4 of an inch. And you're coming in a little bit late to the sitting. And you trip. And you sprawl in the most unbecoming, unvipassana way all over the floor, sliding across a few sabatons. Everyone turns to look. And so you sit down to meditate. And I'm a mindfulness failure. You know, and so the energy, you had such good energy before, and now the energy is not quite there. And I didn't have that sprawling on the floor thing, but when I was a new Zen student, I had a lot of deflation because I specialized in being guilty. And I could be guilty for anything. So I used to, even just, I remember very clearly, painfully, even how I walked across the meditation floor, I was guilty. It's just a good policy to be guilty. And, you know, so that's one of the things I got to see over and over again in my early years of practice, how much guilt I carried with me, uncaused guilt. Isn't that great? Guilt without a reason. That would be my t-shirt. And so anyway, all these forces in mind, these beliefs we have, these thoughts we have, these comparisons we make with ourselves and others can be deflating. There can be feelings that we have, ideas we have, memories we have, that we resist and don't want to do. So we hold at bay, and that's also deflating. And so the mind gets tired and sleepy. It gets dull. And so we have to kind of then slog through this sloth and torpor. And that covers over our connectedness, covers over our ability to be alert, at home with ourselves, coming to our senses. And then there's a fourth hindrance, which is agitation and regret. And agitation, restlessness, is all the ways we're kind of hyped up, kind of energized. The mind is spinning, going fast. And, you know, where it's really strong, then, you know, it's really hard to settle down. It's kind of like this centrifugal force or this Mexican jumping beans jumping up, you know, from our chest, maybe for me, like from the chest up, you know, like, oh, you know, like I'm having too much caffeine. Spinning around my thoughts. And when I'm agitated and energized or restless, most of where I live is from the upper part of my chest up to my head. Like that's where I kind of like everything's swirling. And when I feel at home in myself, then I'm much more centered and grounded below that. It's kind of like I come to rest and relax, soften, settle in. And so what is it that causes us to be agitated, causes us to be restless? It can be a lot of the same things. It can be really strong desire. It can be strong aversion, strong disappointment, discouragement. It could also be regret. And actually that's one of the pairs of this fourth hindrance, agitation and regret. That a very strong regret can keep the mind spinning and agitated and keep us, again, disconnected from ourselves, or disconnected from the fullness of who we are. Make it difficult to feel at home here in this body. And then the fifth hindrance is doubt, or indecisiveness, or what's another word for this? I think of it also as a kind of a lack of commitment, unwilling to kind of give oneself over to what we're doing. Just doubt, hesitation that comes along. And sometimes it's said that doubt is the most dangerous hindrance, because doubt is the one that can get people to stop practicing. They can have strong doubt about the practice, strong doubt about themselves as a practitioner, strong doubt about the teachers, strong doubts about the place, strong doubts that this is the right time of year for practice, strong doubts about this is the right century for practice. You know, better wait. So doubt can get people to kind of stop practicing. And doubt has, you know, all the other hindrances can have to do with other things besides the practice. But the doubt is most often, in terms of practice, most often have to do with the practice itself or ourselves as a practitioner. I can't do it. I'm not up to it. What should I do? How should I do it? Should I really give myself over to it? Is it okay? Is it safe to practice? I don't know about this. I have my doubts about getting any closer. I have doubts about relaxing. I have doubts about letting go. I have doubts about meeting myself and really seeing what's there. Will I be safe if I do this practice? Will I be safe if I let go of what I'm clinging to? Will I be safe if I no longer have strong desires? Or will I be safe if I'm no longer angry all the time? But my anger protects me. Will I be safe if I stop being restless and running around? Because if I stop running around and being busy, agitated, then I have to face what's here. And maybe it's not safe to be present and see what's here. It's too difficult. So there's a whole slew of doubts that can arise in practice. And they are a centrifugal force out from the center that keeps us from centering, keeps us from coming home, being home, coming home. So the task is to become familiar with these when they operate. And it's very important to understand that when a hindrance arises, that these are not personal failings. They're human tendencies. As far as I can tell, all humans have the, I don't know if it's software or the hardware, probably software, to have the hindrances. They just come with being born. And so if you have a hindrance, welcome. This is how it is to be a human being. It's not a personal failing. It just means that you're a person. But it is a task to practice with it, to bring your mindfulness to it, to study it, to investigate it. And if you can manage this, I'd encourage you to feel a certain degree of happiness and contentment that the hindrance has shown up. Not to reinforce it, not to continue in it, but so you can study it. You can take a hard and fast look at it and say, oh, this is what it's like. And so there's four steps to practicing with hindrances. And this is the acronym RAFT, R-A-F-T. And the first is to recognize it. And that's maybe, could be possibly the most important one, at least for some people sometimes, to simply to recognize that it's happening. Until it's recognized, it has a power over us. It kind of has us by the nose, pulling us around. We're under its influence without even being aware of it. Or we might feel that something is kind of not right. We feel somehow a little bit off, but we don't know what it is. So just stop, breathe, feel, sense, look, what's going on? Oh, I have a lot of desire. I'm standing in the lunch line. It's a long line down there, if you're at the end of it. And I'm crowding the person in front of me and trying to look over their shoulder to see, is there going to be enough of those, you know, whatever they're having for, you know, it's enough for me, and I really want them. You know, can I take more than one? You know, how many can I take? You know, and should I cut in the front? Because I might not be any by the time I'm there. By the time you're up there, you're exhausted from all this planning and all this planning and thinking and wanting and you know, but so, oh, it's desire. This is a universal human phenomena, desire. So, oh, that's all it is. It's just a desire. A dime a dozen, okay. I'll settle back and just breathe. So desire. So to recognize the hindrance is very helpful. It can take some of the power over it because you see it. Or as Bob told the other day from his teacher, that to know it is to have knowledge. To not know it is to have cultivate ignorance. The second is to allow it. And I like the word allow rather than accept, because in my vocabulary, accept is a little bit too close like condoning something. But allow simply means to let it be there in the field of our awareness. It's not justifying its presence. It's not approving its presence. It's just kind of allowing it to be there so that we're not entangled with it. So we're not for or against it. So we're not making more stories about it and making ourselves, you know, more unhappy because it's there. So this idea of allow, make space for it. So I'll take a little detour for a moment about allow and making space. So this afternoon I had to take care of one little piece of business for IRC. And because I got a phone call. So some of you know, probably noticed the bench down there that on the hillside that's has a plaque for Marty Martyr. Well, his daughter called me this morning asking to talk to me. So I hadn't seen her since Marty's memorial service. And so I called her back and we talked a little bit. And she was kind of a little bit in tears, but she wanted to tell me how important this practice was for her father. She said, I grew up with my father and he was always anxious. It was quite something to grow up with someone who was always anxious. But he was anxious most of his adult life. But then he discovered this practice, and his anxiety started to go down. And then she got really kind of choked up and said, then he was dying. In the last 2 months of his life, he was no longer anxious. And it was because of the practice. Not only that, but he would lay there and say, kind of, it's all so wide open. It's all so wide open. So to allow, to make space, to be open, to discover the beautiful capacity of being open, to feel a sense of open awareness, allowing awareness, where we're not so concerned about what we're aware of anymore. We have to be aware of something. So we have these hindrances, and to discover that just how wonderful it is to kind of relax, open up. It's kind of like taking your arms like this, and it can feel so good. To spread your arms wide, you know, maybe it's even, it doesn't really matter what's in front of you. It just, you know, maybe matters a little bit, but you know, just like, ah. So to have an open awareness, relaxed, spacious awareness to what's going on, at some point becomes more satisfying than what you're aware of. And that's a radical shift. Because many times we're concerned with the what we're aware of. What's happening I don't like, I want to fix it. What's happening is I want it. But what's happening? Maybe it can just be what it is. But you can discover this, the wonderful pleasure of allowing, this allowing open awareness. So anyway, so the first by hindrance is to recognize. The second is to allow. The third is to feel. To feel. And this means to come to your senses. So that you allow your senses, all your senses, to sense and feel what's happening for you. And I think that for a big part, when it's your inner psychological states, it has a lot to do with feeling it through your body, the sensations of your body that come into play. And so what does it feel like to be consumed with desire? What parts of the body are active and energized? What sensations come into play? What sensations come into play when you're angry, when you have sloth and torpor, when you're restless, when there's doubt? Find some way to recognize how it is physically. And that one of the advantages of that is that the body is never a story. The body is just a phenomena. And if you ground yourself in the physical expression of the hindrances, you're less likely to be caught up in the stories that are reinforcing the hindrances. It's also a way of allowing, giving more space to, more allowing space for the experience to be there. To let the body be the container, let the body hold the experience. Our thinking mind is, you know, much smaller than the spacious sensing body. And so the body has lots of room to let things be processed, to let things unfold, to let things move in a way the thinking mind often doesn't. So to kind of relax into the body and feel it there and let the body hold it, kind of like you would take two hands and cup them together and just hold something that was delicate in your hand like this. Just hold. Feel it in your body and just hold it with awareness. Let it rest in your awareness and then see what happens. And it's a way of beginning to awaken the body, awaken the senses of the body, becoming embodied. For the Buddha, becoming embodied is so important that probably we should have translated sati into English as bodyfulness instead of mindfulness. The Buddha said things like, there is no attaining the deathless. There is no attainment of liberation without mindfulness of the body. And he had one discourse where he goes through all these different phrases of the same things. There's no attaining the deathless without mindfulness of the body. There's no plunging into deathless without mindfulness of the body. There's no resting in deathless without mindfulness of the body. I mean, he wants to make this point that the mindfulness of the body is so important. Many people associate Buddhism with the mind, and the mind is certainly important, but perhaps the mind is just a nice subset of the body. Maybe the body is the bigger mind. So to come into the body, how does it feel? What does it feel like? It's very respectful to feel what's really going on. So feel the hindrances, make space for them. What's it like? Stand in a lunch line full of desire for lunch and close your eyes and feel it. This idea of feeling is connected to the idea of taking your attention and turning it around 180 degrees and feeling feeling the subjective experience of what's happening. Because often with a hindrance, especially with desire and ill will, there's often an object that we have desire for, or an object of our ill will. And there's a dichotomous relationship or dualistic relationship between us and the thing we're focusing on. And so, so rather than keeping that attention outwardly directed towards the object of our desire, the object of the ill will, in mindfulness practice, we can turn the attention around 180 degrees and look and see, what does it feel like to be desiring? You don't have to get rid of your desire. Just kind of turn away from the object of desire and feel the desiring. You don't have to get rid of the object of ill will. Just turn around and feel what it's like to be ill-willing. What does that feel like? What's the texture, the flavor, the smell of having it? How does it feel in your body? So recognize, allow, feel, and then we come to T. And the T of raft is to tease apart. And as we start allowing and feeling and being present and seeing clearly, we can start teasing apart the different strands of what the experience is. We can see that part of the experience is physical. Part of it is cognitive, thoughts and ideas and stories. Parts of it is motivational, what we want. Parts of it might be emotional. There might be strong emotions, variety connected to the hindrance that's there. Some of what's going on is our relationship to it. We have a hindrance and we're really invested in it. We believe in it. Or we're glued to it. Or it's glued to us. We feel this very strong bond and connection. We're very interested in it. So how are we relating to the hindrance? Do we believe it? Are we invested in it? Do we give it a lot of authority? Do we give it a lot of, do we feed it with a lot of energy? Do we feel aversive to it? Do we feel angry? Do we feel discouraged to it? How are we relating to it? Are we defending it? Are we protecting it? Are we trying to destroy it in some kind of aggressive way? What is the relationship? And a lot of mindfulness practice has to do about clarifying that relationship we have with our experience so that we're not entangled with it. We can allow the experience to be what it is. We don't have to be opposed to it, but we can simplify our relationship so we're just mindful of it. We're just aware of it without all the extra entanglements of being for and against, without making a story about it or coming to conclusions about it or being, you know, all these things. So to tease apart the strands connected to the hindrances and all that's going on with them. It doesn't have to be a complicated analytical process, but it can be a process kind of just staying quiet and recognizing and looking, being present, allowing it, feeling it, sensing it, and allowing it to begin showing itself to us. The simple question, what is this? What's going on here? And as you stay present slowly, it begins to show itself more of the strands of what's happening. And we start teasing them apart. And as we tease apart the different component parts, it becomes less less compelling. It becomes less this kind of amorphous blob of stuff that's hard to get your handle on. But as you kind of see it as different things, it's like, oh, it's just phenomena. It's just stuff going on. One of the ways that we complicate our relationship to the hindrances is taking them personally, using them to define ourselves. I'm a good person, I'm a bad person, look at me, don't look at me. All these ideas about ourselves. And that's another strand. And so to tease apart the self-identity issues that might come into play, and maybe let them fall away. And so rather than having this idea, it's my hindrance, it's my desire, I'm desiring, it's much simpler just to recognize desire is happening, ill will is happening. To add the idea of me, myself, and mine is just an extra strand that makes it more complicated than it needs to be. And so with time, we're learning to make our lives less complicated in the moment, simpler, so that the centrifugal forces, the spinning that happens, that keeps us disconnected from ourselves, begins to settle, and we begin to find how to come to rest in our hearts, come to rest in our bodies. So we come home, coming home, and then staying home. Once you're at home, stay at home, but come home. Come home here. I suspect that if you look deeply enough, feel your way deeply enough, sense deep, listen deeply, deeply inside of you, in your heart, your heart's heart, there's something that's kind of going, hey, you, come here. Come here. This is the place. This is your home. This is where you can find peace and well-being. Take the time. This is important. Take the time to work through those layers. Let all the different layers shed themselves over time. Begin to kind of feel and sense and open to what's here until a day can come where you feel settled, at ease, and at home in this body, in this heart. And as you do that, your heart can be a home for all beings, not just for you. May we all hold each other in our hearts.